HIV. Just those three letters bring up so many images, some from the adverts from the 80s, some of people on their deathbeds. The thought of HIV, oh, it's a death sentence, oh, we can catch you from all sorts of things. But is that really the case? Spoiler, it's not. What's it like living with HIV? What's it like living with a partner who has HIV? Can you have a good quality of life together? That's what we're looking at today in this episode with my special guest, Dan Sadler.
You're listening to the Keith Blakemore Noble Radio Show, helping you transform your deepest fears into your greatest strengths. Here's your host, Keith Blakemore Noble.
Hey, hey, hello. Welcome back to another episode. And this episode, I'm very pleased to be joined by a gentleman by the name of Dan Sadler. Now, Dan was born and raised in a quiet village near Portsmouth and was brought up by his mum and his two sisters. Dan became a successful young musician and an educator after he was introduced to the steel pan instrument at secondary school. After many years performing all over the UK, touring over 50 countries, multiple TV appearances, and performing at concerts in venues like the Royal Albert Hall, the Royal Festival Hall, and even performances numerous times for Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, he made the move to London to further develop his musical career. And that was where he met John, and he settled down into a new life in London. What he didn't know at that time was that that journey would lead him to start his own businesses, becoming a biohacker and wellness expert, to start public speaking, and also to work with the UK's largest business network. While music is still a strong passion, it's now something Dan does mostly for the love of music and not relying on it to earn income. Now, HIV, the topic of today's episode, HIV wasn't something that Dan had given any consideration to until he found out that his partner was living. Today, he finds himself speaking about HIV more and more based on his experiences living with it. He now has the ability to empower others to see that it's not necessarily a death sentence anymore. That's why Dan's with me today. He's here to speak about his journey and to dispel some of those myths. Hey, Dan, how are you doing, sir?
Hi, Keith. It's so glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me to come and talk with your lovely audience. I'm great, thank you. Very excited.
Good to hear. And thank you so much for taking time out to talk with us about this. I know it's a very, very personal topic, and I know a lot of people will be able to pick a lot of useful information from this. Before we dive in, we've heard your bio. We've heard a bit about some frankly amazing places that you've played and performed. But who is Dan in a nutshell? Who's Dan?
Who is Dan? Right. Okay, so I am a creative-led person. Everything about my history and my past screams creativity, from touring and performing to composing and arranging music to just everything about me. It always involves creativity. Even when I started to set up my business, I was more enthusiastic about the creative side and the developing stuff than I was about kind of the nuts and bolts of it. So that still runs through me. The creativity still runs through me. But as I said, like, music is something now that I do for the love more than for the income, because 25 years in the music industry, and a lot of musicians end up relying on teaching, on education to provide an income. And education for me is not it's not the place that best suits me. It's not the best place for my energy. So just a little bit more about my story is, when I moved to London was probably the most impactful and the biggest change that I'd ever made in my life. So I moved to London in 2013, it was like going back 10 years in the past, but in a new place. It was like I was a young man again. I was living on sofas and moving around from house to house, and I was picking up all these little jobs in schools, and that was the main intention for moving to London. But I picked up a specific job in Chislehurst, which is where I live now. And it was on the way down to Chislehurst from Tottenham. If you know London, it's there. They're on the opposite side. So I was living in North London and travelling down for work. The first real job that I got in London felt like an eternity away, like in terms of distance. It felt like a million miles from where I was living. And just to make matters worse, there was tube strikes on the first day that I went down to that job. So I didn't actually make it on that first day. So the second week when I went down there, it was actually, I'd gone down, I'd done the teaching job, it was all good, and I was on my way home. And I bumped into John on the train platform, and we just started chatting, and we just started getting to know each other. And that was really the start of the journey for HIV for me. And it was also a big part of our journey of health and wellness, how I became a biohacker. And I just want to dispel one myth there about biohacking. It's not like crazy computer hackers that are trying to mess you up. Bio means body, and hacking genuinely means optimization. So what I do is looking at scientifically validated ways to enhance your body's performance. And that's where I am now, trying to help people do that.
Gotcha. That must have been quite the commute for your first job from the top of London to the south. Nice. But, of course, if it hadn't been for that, you wouldn't have met John. And that means we wouldn't have been talking about what we're talking today, which is all about HIV. Now, we're going to dive into exploring the myths about living with HIV. But just before we do, for people who maybe not fully aware of what it is. What actually is HIV?
Okay, so HIV is a human immunodeficiency virus. It will backtrack via your body mechanisms through your RNA into your DNA, and it will basically change and create a new way for your cells to be created going forward. So the virus is a very clever virus that can hide in the body. And your immune cells, your helper cells, your white blood cells, for example, they can't identify it as a virus or as a baddie in the body. And I believe that's genuinely because of the way it backtracks into the DNA. So when you move forward and new cells are created, then the viral cells are able to go undetected in the body, which is why it's incredibly hard to heal from or to even to treat. It is a very, very big virus. It's a problem in the world. And so hopefully by speaking about it, we can just help people to learn to live with it better. Because that seems like the only option we have right now.
Very true, very true. And I remember when HIV first started becoming really well known back in the 80s, there were all those awful adverts, the tombstone adverts, and it was widely seen as a death sentence. We could list countless celebrities and people in the entertainment industry, as well as millions of ordinary people who succumbed to it. It was also at that point very often known as the gay disease. And I think that's one thing that we really need to clear up. It doesn't just affect gay people, does it?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I did a speech on this with my dear friend Sharon, who's a female who has HIV, a straight female. So it's definitely not a gay disease. And the tombstone ads, funny you mentioned those, because those really did affect me when I was a young man. Seeing people looking like corpses, being blasted all over the TV and on billboards and stuff was horrifying. I would say that is probably the biggest thing that affected the stigma of HIV today is the way that it was portrayed in the 70s and 80s. And we know now that HIV is not necessarily a death sentence. You can live a normal, healthy life. And I'm here to tell you that I don't actually have HIV, but I live with somebody who does. So even me, as somebody that's negative, can live with somebody who's HIV positive and still be healthy and still live a normal, happy life myself without fear, without worry. And so it's very easy to be picked up by the stigma. I assumed that you couldn't drink from the same cup as somebody that had HIV. I assumed that if somebody cut themselves in your vicinity, that the best thing you could do could be to run away from them and let them bleed to death if necessary, because you don't want that blood anywhere near you. And actually, after it's taken me a long time to get to this stage. Now, maybe I'll tell you the story in a minute of when I found out about John and how it felt and what I went through. But on the other side of it now, it was education that really helped me understand more about it and to be able to live in peace with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that story we are going to dive into, because I think that's going to be very, very relevant in this world. So just before we do that, we've looked at the myth of it being the gay disease, which we know it's not. It can affect absolutely anybody. Also, you touched on it there, the myth about how you could catch it by drinking from the same cup or by shaking hands with somebody who has it and all that nonsense. None of that. It is much harder than that to catch. You're not going to catch it just by being in the presence of someone. Big myths, which used to be very, very widespread. Now, you mentioned about how you met John and your story about coming to terms with living with HIV, or in this case, living with somebody who has HIV. Tell us a little bit about that, just to give us a bit of background to what's going on here.
Of course, yes. Yeah. So if you can imagine, when I'd moved to London, I left everything in Portsmouth. Everything behind me was kind of shut down. I kept in contact with my family and a few close friends, but I moved up here to start a new life. I didn't expect within the first 6 months to meet someone. I was genuinely not in that place where I was looking to connect with any one specific person or to start a relationship. It just happened that way. And it was a lot of interesting set of circumstances. So I came down to this place, Chislehurst, where I live now, to work. I met John on the train. I was doing a lot of sofa surfing, as I said at the time. So at the time, it was an opportunity for me to connect with somebody down here, to build some friends or a social circle down here, so that potentially I didn't need to always be in Tottenham. There might be times when I could choose to stay here, or I might even want to live here eventually. And it just so happened that after about 3 months of doing that job, I started staying down with John on Tuesdays, because the job was on Wednesdays. And then Tuesdays and Wednesdays would change to Tuesdays to Thursdays after another couple of months. And I was staying down for Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday and working in the middle. And then it just kind of spiraled out of control. I was spending more time down here than I was up there. And I was basing myself in Chislehurst. Now, about 6 months into our, what you could say, relationship, it was a slow starting one. We were just very much playing it cool to start with. And I had no idea that John was dealing with this, or that he'd been living with it for 10 years. He'd been very, very clever about not exposing me to the medications and the other stuff. And because he knew that my lack of education around the subject could potentially cause me to run away without having a conversation or a debate. He also knew that while he had zero viral load, so this is how they detect in the body, they're checking your viral load and they're checking your white blood cell counts. So your viral load needs to be low as possible, preferably zero, and your white blood cells need to be as high as possible. I've seen the highest I've seen in somebody with HIV is about 1,500, and that's really good going. You normally don't start to hit the deathbed until you reach under like 50, 20 white blood cell counts per milliliter. So John knew all this stuff and I didn't. So I'm not surprised why he didn't expose me to this information sooner. But it came to a point where our relationship was developing so much that the longer that he didn't tell me, the harder it became. I'm sure you understand. Yes. So after about 6 months, he dropped the bomb, and I reacted just as I explained earlier. I freaked out. I literally ran away. I went back to Tottenham, started sleeping on the sofas and the floors again. But I was actually genuinely in such a state of fear that I wouldn't even pick up the phone when he called me, and I wouldn't call him back. And this went on for about 2 or 3 days until one specific moment where he called me. I think I was in Tottenham coming out of a job in a school, waiting for a bus. And he called me and I answered it. There was a longing there inside me. There was something that was missing. There was something about the previous 6 months that told me that I actually genuinely needed to be with him, near him, around him. There was a pull. There was something pulling me back there. So I answered the phone and we had a conversation. John had a chance to explain a little more to me. He helped me out by booking me an appointment at a test centre in central London. And we arranged to meet that evening. So we met at about 7 o'clock. I think it was somewhere in Kensington. And we went along to one of the main HIV centres that where they do a lot of the tests in London. And I was a gibbering mess. I was shaking like a leaf, crying my eyes out, actually. I was like a baby, like I've regressed 35 years. And I was sat in this place. And as I got called up, it just got worse. I could barely walk into the room. The woman could see that I was a mess. So rather than just give me the blood test, which would have taken about 2 or 3 days to get me the results, she could tell that I was going through so much anxiety that she gave me the instant test and the blood test, so the more definitive test. So she gave me 2 tests on the day rather than one like she should have done. So really nice lady. And that put me at ease. So as soon as I knew, John had been trying to convince me, you don't have it. You don't have it. There's no way you can have it. I still didn't believe him because I didn't know. But I didn't have it. So that was a platform for us to rebuild our relationship. It didn't need much rebuilding, to be fair. There wasn't much love lost. As soon as I realized that I was safe, we started to implement things that could help me help me deal with it. So John called up his specialist and she came around the house. And she just basically answered my questions for about 2 hours. Any question that I had, she had the answer for. And everything she said taught me so much, to the point that after that 2 hour conversation with an expert, I was an expert myself, basically. I understood how it worked. I understood what we needed to do.
Got you. So, I mean, what are kind of the biggest questions that someone in that situation might have? Someone who's just discovered that somebody that they're dating is HIV positive, or perhaps somebody that they know, a friend or whatever. What's kind of going to be the biggest questions that are going through their mind, and what are the answers that you can offer to help reassure them?
Okay, well, the best thing I can think of is just think about the questions that I was asking, because my questions were more about sex. They were about the safety of it. And they were about the use of contraception and how it helps. It all seems like quite basic stuff, but I was also interested in how I can break this to my family, how I can tell them, because that was, when it came round to it, that was actually just as hard as finding out myself, actually having the guts to tell my mum, my dad, my sisters, my friends. So I think the first question that I had was based around sexual intercourse and how it can happen and how it can work and what the risks are, what the rates of transmission are of somebody with a zero viral load. Well, I believe strongly that the answer is zero. If you're with somebody who has a zero viral load and has a good white blood cell count, even if they have HIV, you are safe.
Got it. So that's an important point to realize. Does that mean completely safe, or does that mean safe while still taking precautions? What's the level
safe whilst the person that has a diagnosis of positive HIV is on the medications? So, I mean, this is one thing about the medications, is that's another thing to do with the stigma. They are lifelong medications. You will need to take them for the rest of your life. That was scary to me. That was a question that I had. I wanted to get John off the meds if we could in any way possible. So this is actually leading into the next stage of the story now. we actually spent 3 years trying to find alternative ways to treat HIV. And we discovered so many things on the internet, which are claims of cures. And often some of these claims have patents behind them, and they have actual scientific study behind them. But we tried everything. Like, and when I say everything, I don't even want to divulge into the list of things that we took. We tried every herb, every mineral. We tried everything, Keith. And we were spending maybe £500 to £800 a month on supplements and minerals, and everything was organic. Everything was top of the range, the highest quality we could find. And we never did find the magic sweet spot. So what we noticed was is that as we were going through the journey and trying all these different things, that to start with, the viral load stayed very low, and the blood cells stayed, the blood count stayed very high. And that's exactly what we wanted, but it wasn't at zero on the viral load. So we knew we still had work to do. And about 2.5 years in, maybe 2 years in, and we're having regular blood checks at this point, I was also vulnerable because John, at this stage, he had a viral load. So we had to take extra precautions through this time while we were trying to find the magic. We genuinely couldn't. There are people out there that treat it without the antiretrovirals, and every body is different. And people that are off the antiretrovirals will never always have a 100% guaranteed zero viral load. But there must be a way to do it. So as a part of our mission, which is to find a way to eventually get John off the antiretrovirals, because they're very, very strong medications. And while they are currently keeping him alive, we would like to get to the point where we could get him on something more natural. Who knows? With the research that's going on in virology and epidemiology right now, is the answer just around the corner?
Very true. Let's hope it is. So I'm guessing basically the antiretrovirals are, although it's lifelong medication if you're on them, your ultimate aim is use those for now to keep John safe and protect his quality of life and basically keep him safe and healthy, whilst you're continuing to look for what you hope will be the ultimate solution.
Yeah, I mean, really interestingly, that it was around about 2016, I believe. I'm not sure of the exact date, but there was an air flight, a Malaysian Airlines MH17, which was downed over Ukraine on a journey from the Netherlands to Sydney. Now, hundreds of HIV experts had converged on the Netherlands to board this one flight of the day to get over to Sydney for the global HIV and AIDS conference. And that plane was sadly downed over Ukraine by military. Now, who knows? Was that an accident? Was it not? I mean, it's not my place to say, but I mean, it was very interesting that happened, that all of the world's leading experts in HIV would have been on that plane going to that conference. Did the cure for HIV go down with flight MH17? Who knows? Well,
that's certainly a possibility. As you say, we'll never know, but it is a very, very disturbing thought. So just touching on the retrovirals again, I think that's an important point for people to realize, because again, so many people still to this day have the perception that HIV is a death sentence. Once you've got it, that's it. We've seen all the very distressing images. But the reality is, these days with medications and treatments that are available, yes, you need to be on them for life, but you maintain a full good quality of life, the same as anybody who's not HIV positive. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And I genuinely believe that back in the day, the medications were much stronger than they are today. The medications, when they first were facing this challenge, were produced quickly. They were produced to get a very quick result. There are some people out there that would argue and say that the medications are what caused the people in the tombstone kind of videos laying on the hospital beds just completely dying, that it was the high dose AZTs that caused their bodies to go into shock and to cause that to happen. And what's happened is over the years is they've toned the medications down. They're much softer, but they still get the right result. So they've been working on it for years, and there's new medications coming out all the time. So
yeah, let's hope that as they continue to work on it, let's hope they can crack it and come up with a cure. And meanwhile, it's very reassuring to know that if someone does contract HIV, it is no longer a death sentence. You can have a very long, very healthy life.
Absolutely.
It's a fascinating topic. We could talk about this for a long time. Unfortunately, time is catching up on us. Where can people find out a bit more? If people are facing this situation, or they know of people who are facing this situation, where can they find out some more information and get help and just be reassured that they're not alone?
Okay, so if you have HIV, or if you live with somebody that has HIV, or you have a good friend that has HIV, the best people that you can go and talk to genuinely would be the people that the person with HIV goes to. So the clinic, go to the clinic, speak to the experts, get them to answer your questions. Find other people in your situation. So this was a big thing for us, is that for me, I wanted to find another couple that were going through the same journey as us trying to get off the meds. And we couldn't find one person over those 3 years who could give us a clear indication of a way forward for us. That was a big part of it for me, was finding some social proof of people that were actually doing it. Well, we never found that, but fingers crossed that just by getting this message out there, that there are people out there that could potentially help me and John as well. I'm prepared to share my story further and have conversations with anyone that is feeling the need to talk about it. I can't proclaim to be an expert, but I can proclaim to have the experience of dealing with it emotionally more than anything. So if any of your fans and followers and watchers and listeners are looking to connect with me, you can find me on facebook.com/DanSadlerUK. That's my personal profile. I'm more than happy for you to connect with me and more than happy to have a chat with you over there.
Awesome. Thank you. That is a great offer. And I can only imagine what that would have meant to you and John at the time you found out, had there been somebody like you available to chat with. So that's facebook.com/DanSadlerUK.
That is the one. That's perfect.
Brilliant. Connect with Dan there. He'll be more than happy to help you navigate this whole situation. Dan is also available across social media. He's got other links as well. As usual, they're all in the show notes for this episode, which you can find in the usual place, heathblakemanoble.com/show. Look for the one with Dan Sadler. You'll find out his bio, links, sorts. That's really it. Dan, I just want to thank you for taking time out. I know you are a very busy man. I just want to thank you for taking time out to share this with us. It is a very important message that you've helped us to understand that HIV is not death sentence. HIV is not the scary disease that you can catch just by being in the same room with someone. And it is entirely possible to live a long, happy and healthy life with HIV. Thank you so much, Dan. Really appreciate you taking the time. And thank you, dear listeners, dear viewers, for catching us. If you enjoyed this episode, please remember, subscribe, give us a like, give us a rating and a review, share it far and wide. I'll catch you in the next episode. And until then, take care, look after yourself, and remember that change is always possible. And when you change your mind, change your life. Bye for now.
listening to the Keith Blakemore Noble Radio Show, helping you transform your deepest fears into your greatest strengths. To find out more, please visit KeithBlakemoreNoble.com.